The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So welcome. My name is Andrea. And continue exploring a topic that we've been talking about in this class for the last few weeks when I've been here. That of the Eightfold Path. But to start, I'm going to kind of give a little context. We can look at, in some ways, the Buddha offering his teachings as being very similar to a doctor, kind of pointing out to us, highlighting for us our illness. And recognizing this illness does have a cure, that is possible to be free from this illness, and what's the prescription that we need? And so the illness the Buddha pointed to, and actually was his own question in his own journey, was this question of the suffering of being human, that we all, in the human condition, experience forms of suffering. And he had the question for himself at the beginning of his journey, is it possible to be free from this suffering as a human being? Is it possible to be free from suffering? And in his own exploration, he found that it's possible. I'll say he kind of distinguished or kind of teased apart what might typically be called suffering, the conditions of the world. The fact that there's war and illness and stress in the world, the conditions of the world itself, from what might be possible to be free from, which is our relationship to that, those conditions in the world. In the world, there are going to be people that praise us, that blame us, going to be pleasure and pain, going to be people that like us, that don't like us. So there's going to be all of this going on. And if we feel like our happiness, our ease of heart, our peace of heart depends on kind of managing and controlling the conditions of the world, this is where the Buddha says this is a hopeless project. Trying to create the conditions of the world be what we'd like them to be, that's a hopeless project. And yet he did say there is a possibility, a kind of a suffering that is possible to be free of, is the suffering that feels like it's a problem that things are not the way we want them to be. So this is really the suffering that he pointed to that is the illness. That basically, that there's a kind of a resistance in us to things being the way they are. And that this resistance, this kind of trying to hold on to things that were the way we want them to be, trying to push away things that are not the way we want them to be, that project is creating more stress and suffering. And so he pointed to this piece. When he pointed to the possibility, saying that suffering is our illness, essentially, we could say that he said suffering is our illness, and that the kind of suffering, the cause of that, or the underlying disease there, the what do they call that in medicine? Sorry? Affliction, well, the affliction, but the thing like the virus, you know. So we're sick, we have a flu, and there's a virus that's causing it. It's like the source, or the source of our illness, of suffering, is our relationship to experience being usually habitually one of greed, of wanting something to be the way we want it to be, of aversion, of not wanting the things that we don't like, and of delusion, of confusion. And so he pointed to our looking at, or our those activities of mind as being kind of the source of our illness. And so knowing the source, then we can see, is it possible to be free from that? Can we be cured? Can we be cured? Can we live a life that is free from greed, aversion, and delusion? And so this was the question that the Buddha for himself answered, yes, it is possible to be free from greed, aversion, and delusion. And so he offers to us also this possibility. He says it's possible to free the mind from this. Now it might seem kind of hard to fathom what it would be like to not have greed or aversion or delusion, because so much of our usual relationships to the world, when we start looking at it, so much of our usual relationships to the world is based on wanting something to be a certain way, wanting to get rid of something. And the mind can't really hold or fathom in some way that there might be other ways to navigate life. It's almost like we think that if we didn't want something to be a certain way, if we didn't desire or want or crave something, then why would we do anything? If I didn't have this aversion to get rid of something, why would I do anything? It's just so deeply conditioned in us that those are our motivations. That's how we act. How we get around in the world is very much based on these very human, they're human, human patterns, human. We're conditioned in this direction. And yet, again, what the Buddha discovered in the freedom from greed, aversion, and delusion is that there's a whole way of engaging in the world that comes from a completely different source. That when we see something, for instance, injustice in the world, you know, that we would often have a feeling of aversion towards injustice, that it's you know, that we would hate that injustice. And what the Buddha pointed to is the possibility of not hating that injustice, but that not hating that injustice wouldn't mean that we didn't do something. It would mean, instead of acting out of anger or hatred, that a whole different motivation of compassion, of wanting to alleviate that suffering, of wanting to create different conditions in the world around that injustice, that would be a motivation. And yet it's hard for us to fathom in some ways that motivation of pure compassion without having aversion. And yet he points to this being possible. And so holding that maybe as an aim or a possibility for us as human beings. And so he said that it is possible to find our way to releasing greed, aversion, and delusion, to not having those be our motivations in life, and that there is a path. So he offered a prescription, this third thing. So he said, there's an illness, it's the suffering. There's the cause, it's the greed, aversion, delusion. In shorthand, he said, it's ignorance and craving that are kind of at the source of that suffering. And that it's possible to be free of this illness, and that there is a prescription. There are some tools, some paths, some things that we can engage with, that he engaged with to help him come to this freedom, this cure in his own experience, this cure, this freedom from greed, aversion, and delusion. And he, in finding it for himself, was able to articulate it for others, for us. And that cure, that prescription, is the Eightfold Path. And so this is, I would say it's a set of, we could call it eight tools that support us in coming to understand what the Buddha was pointing to. Essentially what we have to do, the prescription that he offers us, is look at your mind. Be curious about your mind with this kind of motivation or this kind of direction of being curious about what is the suffering that's happening in my experience and what part of it is being created by my own mind. So that's really the question. We do see that there's objective things happening in the world that we are not going to be able to necessarily change. And yet the hatred, the anger, the frustration, the confusion, that being something created in our own minds, this is something that can be shifted. We can change our minds. And he offers this path, these tools of the Eightfold Path as tools that help us to change our mind. So the first two pieces of this path are called right view and right intention. And essentially they are kind of helping us, right view and right intention as being the first things that we have to connect with in order to basically understand what the Buddha was pointing at about what is this illness. We have to understand that this sickness or this illness of suffering is something that we can change in our minds. That the greed, the aversion, the delusion is something that is worth being curious about, looking at in our own experience. And the Eightfold Path the kind of the result of the Eightfold Path is that greed, aversion, and delusion begin to weaken and get reduced and eventually fall away in our experience. But the encouragement is not to apply greed, aversion, and delusion to try to get rid of greed, aversion, and delusion. That may be what we think when we hear, oh, greed, aversion, and delusion are the source of the suffering. So what I have to do is figure out how to get rid of them, how to repress them, how to stop them. And what this Eightfold Path is doing is basically saying, you know, applying aversion to aversion is not the way. And so we really have to do a mind turn. We have to shift our mindset around how do we engage with our experience. And the Buddha offered a different way of engaging with our experience. The usual way we have of engaging with something like aversion or hatred or anger, for instance, in that flavor, the aversion side, is that we might either kind of believe it and buy into it and think, yep, acting on that. And we do. We kind of have this habitual movement to when we have that sense of that thing is bad in the world, I hate it, I've got to get rid of it, separate from it, either obliterate it or get myself out of here. That's the movement of aversion, that kind of separation quality. And when we follow the aversion, you know, buy into the aversion, we are believing that that obliteration or that separation is how I'm going to be happy. And we, following through on that, we are essentially encouraging our system we reinforce that pattern, basically. One way the Buddha expressed this is whatever we frequently ponder becomes the inclination of our minds. And so if we frequently engage in that pattern of acting out of aversion, acting out of it, believing it, engaging in it, then it will strengthen. It becomes the way that we then think that's how I need to deal with that situation. So that's one way of that we engage with aversion. Another way we might engage with aversion, being told in our various upbringings, you shouldn't be angry, you know, you should be kind to people, you should not express your anger, that we may repress the anger. And it may kind of go underground and start to eat away at us from underneath. And so there's the expressing of it and the repressing of it that are often our two modes of dealing with something like aversion. And what the Buddha proposed was something radically different. And he called it the middle way. it feels sometimes like this razor's edge between expression and repression, where instead of expressing, we explore the possibility of holding the experience. This is the experience of anger. So we're not repressing it and not expressing it. So this is essentially, you know, the tools of the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path is the definition of the middle way. Really help us to have this completely different relationship to our greed, aversion, and delusion. Not expressing, not repressing, but being with, opening to, feeling into that experience. And so the first part of the Eightfold Path, the wise view, is kind of beginning to take up or have some confidence or faith, perhaps it's borrowed initially, that this is a useful strategy to turn and look at the reactivity rather than either expressing it or repressing it. This takes a little bit of a leap of faith at the beginning. At least for me it did. It's like I had no idea how it would help to turn and observe, be with my anger or whatever reactivity was happening. I didn't understand how that would help. And so it takes a little bit of a leap of faith to do that. And so it's kind of like, you know, the Buddha as a doctor says, hey, this prescription, here's the prescription. You know, and a kind of a simple way to express it is neither repress nor express, but meet in the middle, be with, be curious about, notice the human experience of whatever is arising. And it, you know, so the Buddha offering this to us, it's like, okay, do I believe this is going to work? Do I believe it's going to help? That is what it takes to step into this path, to step onto this path, to pick up these tools, is a sense of confidence that what the Buddha was saying makes sense and is possible for me to do. Now, in my own experience of this, it didn't make sense and didn't see how it was possible for me. And yet, a friend had said, hey, this has been useful for me. Why don't you try it? And so, in effect, I borrowed my friend's trust and saw that my friend had some benefit. It's like, okay, well, it worked for her, so let's see. And so I kind of borrowed that, and then that is what got me to step onto the path. So that's this right view that we kind of are willing to say, this is a different thing, a different direction, I'm willing to engage with it. And then our intentions begin to kind of come into line with that. And so for me, I began being curious about my experience, be curious about my reactive emotions. And so this is the first two, right view, right understanding, and right intention of the Eightfold Path. The next section of the Eightfold Path is kind of an acknowledgement that not only do we have to look internally at what's going on inside of our hearts, but also look at our relationships with other people. And so the next three aspects of the path are really about cleaning up our relationships with people, about finding a way to be in relationship that doesn't create harm. And so this is, again, connecting to this understanding around suffering. You know, if suffering is our illness, then if we are serious about wanting to be free from that internally, that we also have to be serious about not putting it out into the world. And so this is a big piece of our practice, that we engage in ways in relationship with behaviors that do not create harm, with speech that does not create harm, with livelihood that does not create harm. And so that's this middle section of the Eightfold Path, is really looking at our community, our how we are with each other. I love that this is part of the path, because so much in these evenings, you know, we spend time and we sit and we're quiet, and we don't have as much of the engagement with community. But it's very clear that the Buddha's path, his prescription for us, includes engaging with people and looking at how we are in relationship, refraining from harming each other, refraining from taking things from each other, taking what's not given, refraining from using our sexuality in a way that creates harm, refraining from speech that creates harm. So these areas of connection. And then the livelihood, engaging in a livelihood, you know, the simplest way to think about that is that it's a livelihood that allows us to engage with people in a non-harming way, to engage in a livelihood that doesn't harm, that doesn't require us to lie or steal or harm with our sexuality or harm others with their sexuality, and to not kill. So that's a piece of the Eightfold Path, this looking at our relationships. The last section of the Eightfold Path is more about what are the tools, and so these are tools. The first two tools of wise view and wise understanding are kind of the orientation for what is the direction, how do we engage, and what is the ultimate aim of our practice, this understanding how we suffer and why. And so that's the first piece of the path. The second piece of the path, looking at our relationships. The third piece of the path is looking at our own hearts and minds, is what are the tools that help us to turn towards our experience. The middle way that I pointed to around looking at reactivity, of opening to this is what the human experience of anger or hatred or confusion or desire or frustration or irritation or love or joy or happiness, whatever's coming up, what is that experience? The curiosity about it as an experience. So this is again not our usual approach to experience. Our usual approach to experience is something along the lines of, how does it help me to get what I want? What does it say about me? What does this experience have to do with me? As opposed to just being curious about what is this experience? We are always evaluating our experience in terms of how it can further some agenda that we have, some idea or goal of getting something that we want or getting rid of something that we don't want. So the usual way of relating to experience is usually all about me. It's not just simply about, well, what is it like to be feeling this? What is this experience of anger like? What is that? This is, again, in terms of the middle way, this is a hugely, it's a big shift. It's a big shift from what we usually do with something like anger. Again, I described either acting on the obliteration or fleeing or repressing. That's our usual relationship. This question or this curiosity, what is the experience of anger, kind of takes us into a more impersonal relationship to our experience. What's it like to be a human being that's experiencing anger or frustration or whatever the reactivity is? What's it like to be a human being experiencing this? And so this is a piece of that middle way as well. And so the mental work, the inner work, the capacity to be curious about and explore experience from this perspective takes some training, takes some commitment, and takes some skill that is offered in these last three aspects of the Eightfold Path: wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. And so wise effort is the orientation to recognizing what's coming up. Is it helpful or is it not helpful? Is it a flavor of greed, aversion, delusion? Is it a flavor of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion? Does it have a flavor of love, of kindness, of care, of generosity, of connection? And so we begin to recognize these different qualities in the mind and begin to see which ones are actually helpful, which ones help us to move in the direction of well-being, and which ones actually the human experience of the reactive emotions, we quickly see, and this is one of the kind of eye-opening things, at least for me, when I actually touched into the experience of anger in the present moment, I actually recognized, oh, this is the human experience of anger. It was eye-opening for me how painful it was, because my habitual relationship to it had been to be thinking about the other person and the obliteration of that person and how miserable they were going to be when they got the full brunt of my anger. So that whole kind of idea was the biggest thing that the mind was connecting with and attending to. It was not really paying attention to what the human experience of being angry was. And when the mind starts to experience that directly, so this is the tools of wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration, helps us to see what the human experience is. And when the mind actually, when we see for ourselves the experience of this reactivity hurts, that right then and there points out to us that this is not conducive to well-being. It becomes really obvious to us that anger is not the way to well-being, that reactivity, greed, aversion, delusion are not the way to well-being, because it hurts in the moment already. It's already painful. And then we begin to also see the qualities when aversion falls away, or when the mind is experiencing generosity and gratitude and love and compassion and tranquility, when it's experiencing those things, that there's a sense of, oh, this does feel like it's supportive to well-being. And so this wise effort is the mind beginning to learn the difference between these. To learn the difference between what's actually helpful and what's not helpful. And we do this by experiencing the human experience of our what's arising, whether it's reactivity or wholesome states. We begin to know for ourselves what is helpful and what is not helpful. And so this is this wise effort piece, that we begin to get really familiar with these different qualities in the mind and get curious about how can we, again, not act out of the reactive emotions, but also not repress them. Because the repression is also a form of aversion that ultimately just reinforces that pattern of aversion. So this work to get familiar with these qualities in the mind, this is the kind of the definition of right effort, to recognize when there's wholesome qualities in the mind, recognize when there's unwholesome qualities in the mind, and we explore the possibility of letting go of the unwholesome, but not through repression, more through this letting be at first. This holding and allowing that to be here in the moment Oh, this is the human experience of anger. Initially, it may be that we just hold that, let it be, but that is a form of letting go. What we're letting go of there is letting go of the acting out of, and we're letting go of the repressing. And so we are engaging with it in a new way. And then we also explore the cultivation of the wholesome qualities. And what we see, too, is that when we find something like love arising, compassion arising, when we experience generosity and gratitude, just even being aware of that, we feel the benefit of it. And that itself cultivates it. It strengthens it because, again, our system begins to recognize this is helpful. And it orients more in that direction. It's like it almost becomes like there's more of a gravitational pull in the direction of the wholesome as we feel into the experience of these states. Feeling into the experience of these states, this is the mindfulness piece. So this is right mindfulness. We explore our experience by being connected with what's happening in the present moment as a human experience. This is a simple definition of mindfulness, to know what's happening in the present moment while it's happening. Not a judgmental way of holding it, not trying to fix it or change it, but just knowing it. Like mindfulness is kind of like a mirror. It just reflects, this is what's happening. This is what's happening. And the wise effort creates a little bit of discernment about recognizing, oh yeah, this part, this is unwholesome, this is unhelpful, and this is helpful. And so the mindfulness reflects what's happening. It also creates the conditions for us to hold it a little bit in a new way. Hold it without expressing or repressing. And then we come to the final piece of the path, the wise concentration. Now this piece is, this is the piece that really allows the mindfulness to do its job, I would say. Concentration is a quality that lets the mind be really stable, lets the mind be continuously mindful. Essentially, actually, what concentration is a stability of mindfulness over time. It may be experienced as a stability of mindfulness with one experience, such as the breath. Or it may be experienced as a stability of mindfulness on changing experience. So two different basic flavors of concentration. And they're both part of this wise concentration. Both aspects are part of this wise concentration. So concentration is described as a kind of a settledness of mind, a unification of mind, a mind that's not scattered and not distracted, a mind that's able to be present, that's able to be here. And so it is this mindfulness that is present over time. The purpose of concentration in this path, in terms of this prescription, is to help to stabilize the mindfulness so that we can not keep shifting into the reactivity, our usual habitual way of being with our patterns and habits, without a stability of mindfulness. And this happens. This is a normal part of the development of the tools of the mindfulness. It will come and go at first. And we will maybe be able to be present with something like anger for a little while, and then we get caught by it. And then we wake up and we recognize it, and then we maybe can be with it again. And so we just learn how to apply the tools of mindfulness and wise effort to encourage and support that connection with experience, recognizing that it is going to be a little bit on and off for a while. And yet over time, as we basically, the wise effort and wise mindfulness together create the conditions for the concentration. In fact, there's one teaching that says that the concentration is a natural outcome. When we have confidence in the path, So when we have confidence in that view, that perspective, and there's energy connected with to engage, and there's mindfulness, then concentration follows. The sutta says something like, it is to be expected that one who has confidence, whose energy is aroused, and whose mindfulness is established will become concentrated. And so it's a natural outcome of engaging with the mindfulness and energy. And the purpose of the concentration is almost like the purpose of sharpening a knife. If mindfulness is a knife that helps us to really understand and see what's going on in our minds, concentration is like the honing of that knife. It allows that knife to do its job much more effectively. And so as I mentioned a moment ago, there's two different flavors of concentration, and I want to just speak about each one just a little bit. The most common way that people understand concentration, the word concentration is often used in terms of focus. You know, when we talk about being concentrated, usually we mean we're focused on something, that it's narrow, that it's just one thing that we're focused on. And so that's kind of the word that we use here for the Pali, which is samadhi. The word that we use to translate that word, samadhi, tends to have a flavor that we take it to mean this very narrow focused experience. And this is one way that concentration works. This exploration of meeting, being with one experience. So we pick an object, for instance, like the breath, and just see if we can stay with it. Just stay with it, stay with it. This creates the conditions for the mind to kind of gather and collect and settle around that one experience. It takes some effort to do this. It takes some it's like what will happen there is that as we try to stay with the breath, as we try to stay with one experience, the mind will habitually go off. It will kind of wander. And so we kind of just do a very simple practice of, okay, well, that's not the breath, so just come back to the breath. And so the work really in a concentration form of practice, in this one-pointed kind of focused kind of concentration, is to just pick that object and anything else, we just set it aside. Not with aversion, but we just remind ourselves, that's not what I'm doing, come back to this. Oh, no, not what I'm doing, come back to this. In this process of trying to do this, what we essentially get to see are a whole bunch of things in the mind that kind of are habitual that keep us from being concentrated. And there's a list that the Buddha has of five states of mind that tend to hinder concentration. They are habits of mind, essentially. They are ways that we've engaged in our lives that tend to keep us scattered. And these include sense desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, kind of dullness and sleepiness, restlessness, the mind just kind of jumping around, and doubt. And so what will happen as we explore staying with one experience is that these qualities will begin to be highlighted, because they are what kind of keeps us from being concentrated. And so that's part of the practice. If you start to do some kind of a concentration practice, you will notice these qualities coming up in your mind. This is not a mistake. It's actually kind of how it works that we start to see this. And there's a couple different ways to work with it. In concentration practice, again, we explore the possibility. Sometimes we might just recognize, okay, yep, mind pulled into thinking about what I want for dinner. Okay, just can I let that go? Remember, I'm paying attention to the breath right now. So it's kind of a setting aside, almost let it, like, can I just ignore that? Like, not repress it, but just like, yeah, I know you're there, and yeah, I'm just going to pay attention to the breath. Almost like you do with a small child. It's like, you know, yep, I'll talk to you in a little while. You know, I've got some things to do. You can stand here in the room with me, but I can't pay attention to you right now. So it's kind of that. That's one way that we might be able to work with some of those hindrances. Just set them aside and come back to the breath. But at certain points, certain times, the pull to those hindrances, to those states that tend to be in the way of concentration, is stronger than our ability to just say, yep, okay, just you can wait there, but I'll be with the breath. It's like the kid is screaming at you. It's not going to just sit there quietly while you attend to your work. And so then we may have to actually put our attention more directly on those hindrances and basically practice mindfulness there. So that would be a kind of more direct, okay, what's pulling me away from the breath or whatever experience I'm trying to stay with? Is this wanting these thoughts about this thing I have to do tomorrow? And so not what the instruction here would be is not to think about what we need to do tomorrow, but rather feel into what does it feel like to be a human being that wants to think about what I'm doing tomorrow? What does that wanting itself feel like? And so that would be the exploration, an exploration of what is the human experience of whatever it is that's taking me away from being with the breath. And so there's a lot that we can learn through this kind of practice, because we learn basically about the habitual nature of all of these things that get in the way of the mind being settled and at ease. So we learn about those, and we learn something about how to be with them without repressing them and without expressing them. So this is really helpful. There's a learning process that happens there. And then at times we may, through this practice of setting aside, coming back to the breath or whatever object, we may get tastes or little moments of times when the mind is just actually really happy to be with the breath. And those hindrances are kind of quiet for a while. And we get the taste, we get a flavor of a very different way to be in our minds. This flavor of the mind that is settled, that is composed, that is more just happy to be with something very simple like the breath. The experience can be quite delightful, even blissful. The body, the mind can get very, very still. There can be a kind of a sweetness in the experience. There's a phrase, some of the sweetness comes from the experience of the concentration itself, concentration, just the kind of stability of mind that can be very pleasant. But a piece of the pleasure of the concentration is said to be the bliss of not having the hindrances active. That as those get quiet, we experience the mind that is not being jerked around by all of those habitual things. And it's quite a happy thing to be in that space. And so that's called the bliss of seclusion, being secluded from the hindrances for a period of time. And so this form of concentration practice, this usual form, the usual way we think about what concentration means, this is one way and one kind of big learning can happen. A lot of learning can happen around those habitual activities in our mind. We can learn something about what it means to be not buffeted around by them. We learn something about a whole different way of a whole different kind of happiness, essentially. A happiness that's not depending on getting something in particular, but it's just based on something simple like being with the breath, something that's with us all the time. And so there's a lot that's learned that can be learned by this form of practice, this focused, concentrated practice. But that word concentration, as I said, it kind of indicates to us a focus. But the word that's translated as concentration, samadhi, actually means something like the pieces of the word sam means with, and the adi means something like standing. And so samadhi means something like standing with. Gill has pointed out that the word composed is kind of etymologically similar in English. Come means with, and pose means to stand. And so composed, a mind that's composed. And composure has a different quality than focus, perhaps. We maybe can be composed in the midst of activity. And so this is another form of concentration, this composure that can come with being in the midst of many things happening. And so this is another form of concentration that basically it is comes with a stability of mindfulness as things change. And so basically we are able to stay present with what's happening and not get lost in reactivity around it. So this form of concentration is also extremely powerful in our practice. This is what I would call, in some ways we could call the focused kind of practice. That's a kind of set of practices we could call concentration practices or samatha practices, tranquility practices, practices that quiet the mind. And then on the other side are mindfulness practices that are more oriented to just meeting what's arising, what's coming up. Open awareness practice, for instance, where we just settle back and receive. What's here? What's here? What's arising? What's the next thing? What's obvious? That's a flavor of a more pure mindfulness practice. And the stability that happens there is not a stability that is about landing on any particular experience, but is about the ability of the mind to be with the changing flow of experience and not get pulled into reactivity about any particular thing. And then there's a whole set of practices that are kind of in the middle, which blend the two. Something where we might say, I'll orient to the breath for now, but if something is strong, then I'll let my attention turn to that. So if I'm paying attention to the breath, but then a sound gets strong, I let go of the breath and bring my attention to that. This is a practice that's somewhere in the middle between these two edge ends, the poles of concentration and mindfulness. So the moment to moment concentration also creates the conditions for us to be non-reactive. There's a different learning. Essentially, what happens is when we notice a reactivity arise, we simply bring our attention to that. That's what's arising in the moment. That's what we work with. And then we, with this kind of practice, we need to become very attuned to when that reactivity might get stronger than our ability to meet it. You know, that we have to know when we need to set it aside and say, I'm not able to be with that reactivity right now, so let me put my attention on something else right now. So we may need to use a form of concentration practice in our open awareness practice when something is strong and our mindfulness just can't. I mean, there's so many times that we're exploring what's arising and something is stronger than our capacity to meet it. And so we need to have some tools that help us to navigate that. But the main piece I want to point to here is that there is this other flavor of concentration that is the continuity of mindfulness, and yet it's not a quiescence, it's not that things are really quiet, it's that the mind can hold the whole, like, big show of what's happening. So both are useful in our practice. The understanding in the texts is that the kind of focused concentration, while useful as we're learning about, creating it, and then it can be, we can at some point turn our attention once we have kind of stabilized the mind on some particular experience. Usually the instruction is to let go of that single experience and turn the attention towards changing experience. Because there's an understanding that just staying with one object and to letting the mind kind of move into that object, it creates a lot of stillness of mind. Creates a kind of, the mind can get very quiet, very happy, but it is not in itself, that state of quietness is not in itself conducive to the real understanding of what's going on in our minds, to the understanding of suffering. It's basically constructing something that feels pretty good, that we can hang out in it for a while. And so the moment-to-moment concentration is essentially where the freedom, the real deep understanding of how our mind gets hooked by these habits and patterns of greed, aversion, delusion, that is where, in this moment-to-moment concentration, is where that learning can really happen, and where the freedom, the shifting of our minds, as I said, as we open to our experience, our mind begins to fundamentally recognize certain reactive patterns are not heading us in the direction of well-being, and other states are much more heading us in the direction of well-being. And so this is the mindfulness, the moment-to-moment mindfulness, is what lets that learning happen. And so the concentration is necessary to help us to have that learning. And the one-pointed concentration, for some people, the one-pointed concentration is, it essentially can also give us a place of rest at times. If we've got a skill with that ability to let the mind settle and focus on something, it can create a place where the mind can deeply rest for a period of time. And we sometimes need that. And then the instructions are to turn towards the changing experience. And so shifting from the one-pointed concentration to the moment-to-moment concentration is where and how the practice really moves us in the direction of understanding for ourselves what the Buddha taught, what the Buddha pointed to, the freedom, the possibility of freedom from that greed, aversion, delusion. And that'll be more the topic next week, kind of how that works, that aim of the mindfulness and concentration leading to the understandings. What is that? How does that happen? And so I'll talk about that next week. So thank you for your attention.